Welcome to WRI's Big Ideas into Action podcast. My name is Daniel Baker, Communications Manager here at the World Resources Institute and the host, editor, and producer of this podcast. And this is the first episode of a three-part series called Voices on Supply Chains, about creating sustainable and resilient global supply chains.
So typically a supply chain will include raw materials, manufacturing and processing step, some sort of retail and sales step, and logistics or delivery.
Textbook definition, it's about the different actors or organizations that are connecting supply and demand.
It's about who makes it and under what condition and how it moves between the place the product starts and the place it ends up.
I always think that one of the things that's the most complicated about supply chains is that you constantly change suppliers and they constantly change suppliers. So people often view it as static, like here's my chain and here's where I can measure it. But actually, it is constantly changing and updating.
As you just heard, global supply chains impact basically everyone on Earth. You're either part of the production process for a given commodity or a consumer of that product or service, or both. Think about the phone that you're probably listening to this podcast on.
You can think of a supply chain as something like the roots of a tree. With modern products, such as, say, a smartphone, which may have 300 or more parts, these systems are so extensive, I was told, that the cumulative mileage traveled by all those parts for a smartphone would probably reach to the moon.
Now, global supply chains are important no matter why you're listening to this episode.
Hi, my name's Sherry Heinisch. I currently work at EY as their global sustainable supply chain leader. And I also have a podcast, The Supply Chain Revolution. Sustainable supply chain involves multiple paradigm shifts, and it's not just moving from business as usual to circular or responsible or transparent, the buffet of buzzwords that are, you know, often associated with supply chain, including risk resilience. But it's really thinking about this through the lens of systems and ESG. Historically, we haven't thought about that. And it's going to change the way that we work with each other, the way that we interact with the world around us, including nature.
These system shifts are important for people, nature, and the very economic system supply chains are built on. For example, fixing supply chains means addressing working conditions for the small business employees who work at the start of most supply chains.
So there are literally over 1 billion workers in the world who have jobs but don't make enough from those jobs to support their livelihoods. I'm Dan Biederman, and I am a partner at a venture capital fund that's trying to support, build equity in supply chains, mostly focused on marginalized workers around the world. The name of our fund is the Working Capital Fund. Well-treated workers are more productive workers. Well-treated workers stay at a place longer. They don't leave. They don't run away. They don't try and find another job. And good businesses require a stable workforce and a productive workforce. Just because it's true for us, you know, in knowledge-based workplaces doesn't mean it's not true in manufacturing workplaces. And certainly from the developed world, there are studies that demonstrate it is true. So why wouldn't it be true for people in Bangladesh making clothes or China making electronics or Malaysia making electronics, just as it is for us?
Current supply chain practices fail to value our natural resources, just as one of my colleagues from WRI points out.
Rene Zamora, and I am a senior manager on restoration policy at the World Resources Institute. We live in a world that is ruled by markets in many ways, no? And because it's ruled by markets, we have to acknowledge that there are things that doesn't have a market value, like, for example, a pristine forest in a tropical region in the Americas, for example. It has a value that is not monetizable. No, it has so high value, but it's not. We cannot put it on terms of U.S. dollars or euros. No,
but we can't forget the economic environment that companies operate in. To change supply chains, we need to make a strong business case.
Meaning that you can't just say, oh, if you don't do this, Earth is going to die, we're going to die. Like, that message has been said numerous years. And unfortunately, it's not resonating with a lot of folks. It's resonating with some, but not all. I'm Taj Eldridge. I am the Managing Director for Climate Innovations at GFF Labs. And so perhaps a different way of looking at that needs to be, and that different way could be from an economic standpoint, to say that being more sustainable or resilient can be a way for you to gain more market share. can be a way for you to displace your competitor. You talk in the language of the people, and sometimes you talk in the language of the organization and the organization of the business.
Speaking of language, there has got to be a better way to describe the people and processes that cultivate the food we eat, that stitch together the clothing we wear, and create the technology that connects us. So while we will continue to call this complex system a supply chain, we want to paint a more accurate picture in your mind.
My name is Becca Coughlin, and I am the Senior Advocacy Manager at Remake. Remake is an advocacy organization fighting for fair pay and climate justice in the fashion industry. Personally, when I think about global supply chains, I think of one of those like detective crime-solving boards with all like the pins and the thread linking all the different pieces of evidence together. And, you know, it looks all like incredibly convoluted and complicated.
My name is Brian Lipinski. I work in the food program here at World Resources Institute, and I serve as the project manager for our 10 by 20 by 30 initiative, where retailers work with the suppliers within their supply chain to cut food loss and waste. So it's not always a direct linear approach, but there's shortcuts, there's sometimes reverse situations happening, so it can really get quite tangled quite quickly. So, you know, actually, maybe it's more of a big bowl of noodles that is all tangled up together. And some of them are short and some of them are long.
It's like in Google Maps, you have one way that is the most shortest path, but you have 10 other ways, depending on if there is traffic or if not traffic. The same is with the value chain.
My name is Namit Agarwal. I work as the social transformation lead at the World Benchmarking Alliance. So basically trying to put people looking at companies' accountability on human rights, decent work, ethical action in their operations and supply chains as well. I think it's way more than a horizontal chain. It's similar to a forest where there are different parts of the forest, trees, plants, animals, insects, water. And if any of those parts is not in harmony, then I think the forest is compromised. So for me, a supply chain is also similar to a forest ecosystem.
Those are much better descriptions, which is important because an accurate description of the problem is the first step towards solving it. At its core, our problem with global supply chains is that business as usual cannot continue.
I'm Jason Judd. I'm the executive director of the Global Labor Institute at Cornell University in New York. The purpose for the lead firm is to maximize profit. So let's say flooding interrupts production or extreme heat is reducing productivity. Well, the supplier's not going to get a break on the price from the buyer. They're just going to have to eat the cost. And eat the cost might mean forcing workers to work more hours without additional pay, or to push through flooding in their neighborhoods, which means damage to their health. So when I say workers are bearing the cost, that's what I mean.
Adele Gitounis, associate professor with the School of Business at the University of Victoria. If we continue business as it is, probably there will be those science fiction where we have only some pockets of people living on this earth and the rest have really left or died. So we'll be this kind of now, the planet of abundance and supporting lives will probably be a desolation because we will go through probably a cycle of extermination. So are we going to be as a humankind part of that future or not? That is our decision.
With that uplifting prediction in the back of our minds, we can now really dive into supply chains and the decisions and choices that corporations can make to build resilient ecosystems for their products or services and the people that make them.
If we put humans at the center of everything that we do, in being a successful business or organization, you also have to think about meeting their needs. And that opens up a lot of things around equitable workplaces, certainly accessibility, fair wages. None of these things I find are common with the risk resilience thread. We hear a lot about disruptions from climate change are difficult to predict and plan for, and how does that impact your operational footprint, and are you creating redundancy in your sourcing? And, you know, you think about geopolitical risk and how that impacts your product design and the materials that go into your BOM and your manufacturing process to meet that customer demand, but we don't talk about the social angle as much.
The brutal shock of the COVID-19 pandemic exposed a glaring blind spot in corporate supply chains.
Up until that time, large companies couldn't even tell you the identity of many of the companies in their supply chain. My name is Jacques Leslie, Los Angeles Times contributing opinion writer. I write frequently for Yale Environment 360. But the pandemic, I think, should be thought of as a temporary problem, whereas climate change is a much more serious long-range problem.
To prepare for that long-term future, corporations must build more resilient supply chains. That starts with understanding their present circumstances. And by circumstances, we mean understanding the needs of the small and medium-sized enterprises, known as SMEs, the small businesses that make up their supply chain. Now, let's turn back to Dan Viederman and Jason Judd for more on that knowledge gap.
So there are a few dozen to a few hundred big companies that might really understand the needs and the requirements of their top tiers strategic suppliers. They provide either an absolutely core element of the final product, or they are suppliers that are of such technological or potentially sustainability characteristic and quality that the brand or the buyer has decided to focus production on that top tier.
I'd say the buyer, the lead firm's knowledge of its suppliers tapers off pretty fast in apparel or food, but it's only in the last, I'd say, 10 years and intensively in the last 5 years that buyers in the US or in Europe, for example, have had to pay close attention to what happens upstream, what happens beyond tier one.
Upstream means going toward the beginning of a supply chain, which typically consists of those SMEs, the smaller businesses. Tier one suppliers are the ones furthest downstream. In other words, they're right next to the lead firm or the primary corporation. The larger the tier number, the more upstream or further away from the lead firm the supplier being referenced is. So tier two is one step farther from the lead firm or end product than tier one. Tier three is below tier two, and so on and so on. And with that, let's take you back to learning more about the gap between what corporations know about the risk facing their SMEs.
When it comes to companies understanding their supply chain from their own needs and risks, I think they do a fair job. But when it comes to understanding the needs of the suppliers and needs of SMEs, I think there is a big gap there.
And as you move up in the chain of the governance of these big corporations, the more they are actually isolated from the reality of how things really work. And now that some of these corporations starting to wake up to the importance of really what that means to have not sustainable, sustained supply chain, because they discover that they cannot deliver if they don't have those supply chain working.
Large fashion companies need to be financially assisting and incentivizing their suppliers to decarbonize. You know, these companies are the ones that have been profiting off of these emissions and what have you in these countries for years and years, particularly if they're, you know, demanding that their suppliers reduce emissions so that they can, you know, reduce their own scope 3 emissions.
Exactly. Just as Becca Coughlin from Remake alluded to, corporations, whether they're in the apparel sector, food and agriculture sector, or even the clean tech industry, can't reach the ambitious sustainability goals they set without a network of SMEs that have the necessary resources to meet those goals. The Science-Based Targets Initiative defines Scope 3 as all indirect, upstream and downstream emissions. They cover the extraction and transformation of raw materials to the manufacturing, logistics, distribution, use, and end-of-life products. According to the Carbon Disclosure Project, emissions in a company's supply chain are on average 11 times higher than their direct emissions. In short, you can think of Scope 3 as a shorthand for supply chain emissions. So that's why WRI's focus is on the relationship between corporations and the SMEs in their supply chain. And right now, it's pretty one-sided.
I'm Andrew Ola. I'm the founder of the Ethical Denim Council, a nonprofit organization that is trying to bring commercial compliance to the supply chain in the denim industry. Brands can find alternative suppliers relatively easily. When you are a supplier of a garment, to a brand or retailer, you get a big book of rules and you have to comply to all those rules. And if you don't, you have penalties. It's like hungry birds at the park fighting over the little seeds. And the bird who's picking up the seed is not going to demand anything. There is no real pertinent or topical discussion on the treatment of the supply chain by brands that I'm aware of.
Hi, my name is Lydia Elliott. I work in an organization called the We Mean Business Coalition. My official title is Deputy Director of Supply Decarbonization. Some corporations are very reluctant to say an ultimatum to an SME to say you have to set a net zero target or you have to fill out this form or you're no longer in our supply chain, because they do know that you need a certain level of support to help that SME, but they don't always have the internal sets of money and capacity needed to provide that support because it's quite large. So there is a bit of a mismatch of like how much money they have to spend on the problem and how big the problem is.
That disparity matches with what we found in our research. And as Namit from the World Benchmarking Alliance explains, suppliers need corporations, not the other way around.
At the crux of this is the power imbalance that exists between large corporations and suppliers. And it's not a level playing field. Suppliers are really looking for big companies to partner with, to become part of their supply chain. So they are always in this power imbalance where they don't have necessarily the opportunity to be able to negotiate with some of these big companies.
The status quo between buyers and suppliers is already fraying supply chains, as Sherry Heinisch, who hosts the Supply Chain Revolution podcast, lays out.
Generally, the smaller players absolutely shoulder the majority of risk. And when it comes to sustainable supply chains, you have to think, again, a lot of them are still operating through, you know, myopic, old school 1980s, like supplier portals. A lot of this stuff is not automated when it comes to scope 3 metrics, which is a big push right now in terms of visibility. And I think what happens is when they push these new requirements onto the smaller players, they have limited resources. They typically have lower negotiating power. Because they don't have economies of scale unless they have that discrete capability, like it's a manufacturing secret sauce or a material or some sort of like innovative thing that only they do. But oftentimes they don't, and that has lower negotiating power. It leaves them exposed to market fluctuations, environmental changes, political disruptions, compared to larger corporates.
COVID-19 and more frequent and destructive climate events have highlighted serious flaws in corporate procurement policies, particularly around visibility and strategies for addressing vulnerabilities upstream in their supply chains.
I would say there are very few big companies that understand the needs of the SMEs in their lower tiers. They generally, in fact, refuse accountability for lower tier sustainability characteristics or even necessarily business characteristics. They're legally not contracted with those lower tiers. And therefore, it's actually difficult in business terms to take responsibility for an entity with whom you don't have a contract.
Well, the apparel industry is notorious for its willingness to pull up stakes and move somewhere else. This is the history of the industry. Much of New England was home to fabric production and apparel making 200 years ago. And it moved south, and then it moved further south into Mexico, and then it moved to China and Korea, elsewhere. So it's an industry on the move. It's in its DNA to seek out the lowest possible wages. It's typically wages that drive the sourcing decisions, the decision by the lead firm about where to get stuff, because it's price, price, and price. Those are the three priorities for the industry. And when it finds a price that's lower, sometimes it's just across the street. It'll move contracts, it'll change suppliers, and that keeps the suppliers on edge. This constant downward pressure on price seems to be in the DNA of the industry, and it can be enormously destructive.
They're looking at resilience as being powerful enough to cut and run whenever they need to, instead of, you know, looking at battening down like the hatches and making their existing supply chains as resilient as possible. And so they're not going to be able to run forever. And I think that if they continue to do that, there are going to be huge financial implications.
Very costly indeed. By some estimates, environmental risk could cost companies hundreds of billions of dollars moving forward.
But if you see it differently, you know, these investments in SMEs that are working and being more resilient will ensure at the same time that the products that are being delivered to the supply chain are more sustainable, and at the end, the whole value chain is more stable.
Renee from WRI basically just summed up the business case for corporations to invest in and support the SMEs in their supply chain. However, the money is simply not flowing to the SMEs.
It was important for us in the analysis to say the costs of doing nothing are significant, and the costs of a climate adaptive industry are relatively low. And what you have to spend to reduce heat inside a factory, for example, you will soon earn back in terms of improved productivity.
From our conversations with experts, SMEs want to comply with sustainability targets. The problem with their ability to actually meet them can be broken down into three parts.
The themes that we definitely see are barriers of time. So, you know, they don't have the time to include all of this stuff into their daily business because they're already kind of at a max in terms of their capacity. Challenges of funding. They don't have the money to do it, and they struggle to get that money in the way they want to. And then challenges of knowledge. So they don't have the internal knowledge to be able to do something complex like calculate their emissions, which can be very complicated if you're talking about a like 150 person SME that has offices in multiple countries. You know, that is not a simple task to get to your scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions. That is a complicated task. And there are lots of different strategies you could take to do that. But we do see that kind of time, funding, knowledge barriers are repeated.
So before the next devastating flood or debilitating heat wave leaves SME workers to suffer and supply chains broken in their wake, we propose an alternative route corporations can take. Our solution, in a word, partnership. And Brian Lipinski from WRI explains that it's people who make the difference.
There is sort of a pervasive notion that within the private sector, within capitalism, that a company will always optimize all of their behaviors. And we know that's just not true. We know that companies are comprised of people, and people don't always behave in rational ways. They don't always optimize their economic choices. So I think that more than any specific company or any specific sector, it's sort of this mindset of getting over the idea that this isn't an everyone else problem. This is an all of us problem.
Don't miss the next episode, where we'll expand on partnerships, the not-so-secret ingredient that corporations can use to create more resilient supply chains with their SMEs. Thank you to all of our guests who lent their expertise and insights for this edition of Voices on Supply Chains. The story continues at wri.org/crest. For all of us at WRI, my name is Daniel Baker, host and producer for the series, which is funded by the Ares Charitable Foundation as part of their CREST initiative, a 5-year career preparation and reskilling initiative that aims to close the gap between the demand for a skilled workforce for green jobs and the number of people prepared for these opportunities to build an equitable, low-carbon economy. Don't forget to leave a 5-star rating on whatever podcast streaming service you heard this episode on. Every review counts. Thanks for listening.